Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, May 13th, 2006. Here's what we have coming up for you. In our first hour, we bring you an interview with the founders of Band Together, a human rights advocacy project using live music to capture people's attention and turn it toward human rights in the New York City subway system. Then we'll have a live interview with Carol Shea Porter, a progressive Democratic candidate for Congress, vying for Jeb Bradley's seat. In our second hour, we'll hear from Michael Parente on What Progressives Want, Jav Parrish on Medicare Part D, and People's History on Mother's Day. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. First, for some news.
This is Steve Diamond with News You Need to Know. From USAtoday.com, Iran threatens to pull out of nuclear treaty. From May 7th, Iran renewed its threat to withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, with its president saying sanctions would be meaningless and its parliament seeking to put a final end to unannounced inspections of its nuclear facilities. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said he would not hesitate to reconsider NPT membership, speaking as Washington and its allies pressed for a UN Security Council vote to suspend Tehran's uranium enrichment program. He told Iran's official news agency, "If a signature on the international treaty causes the rights of a nation to be violated, that nation will reconsider its decision and that treaty will be invalid." Iran's parliament made similar threats in a letter to United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan, read on state-run radio, saying the dispute over Iran's nuclear program must be resolved, quote, "peacefully, or there will be no option for the parliament but to ask the government to withdraw its signature from a protocol to the NPT allowing for intrusive inspections of its nuclear facilities." President Bush, in an interview with ARD German television, said, quote, "An armed Iran will be a threat to peace. It will be a threat to peace in the Middle East. It will create a sense of blackmail. It will encourage other nations to feel like they need to have a nuclear weapon. And so it's essential that we succeed diplomatically." The Western nations want to invoke Chapter 7 of the UN Charter that would allow economic sanctions or military action to force Iran's compliance. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Hamid Reza Assefi said any UN resolution would be completely illegal and driven by politics. And from the Associated Press, Blair says nuking Iran would be absurd. Prime Minister Tony Blair said that any consideration of a nuclear attack against Iran would be, quote, "absolutely absurd," and said the issue had no bearing on his decision to demote his foreign secretary. Jack Straw, the former foreign secretary, had described alleged U.S. contingency plans for a tactical nuclear strike as, quote, "completely nuts." And from the Washington Post, U.S. under pressure to talk to Tehran. Experts from both parties speak out. The Bush administration is facing pressure both in the United States and overseas to drop its longstanding refusal to talk directly with Iran about its nuclear program, particularly in the wake of the unusual 18-page letter sent this week to President Bush by Iran's president. Foreign policy moderates from both parties have spoken out in recent days, including Senator Chuck Hagel, Republican of Nebraska, who is a potential GOP presidential candidate, former Secretary of State Madeleine K. Albright, former National Security Advisor Samuel R. Sandy Berger, and former Middle East negotiator Dennis Ross. All have published sharply worded opinion articles questioning the administration's stance, and Albright was joined in her commentary by five former European foreign ministers who said they were told by Iranian officials in recent months that there is, quote, "widespread interest" in holding a dialogue with Washington. Critics of the administration's approach assert that diplomacy has failed thus far because Iran has little incentive to deal as long as its main antagonist, the United States, is not at the table. They also note that the failure of the United States to negotiate with Iran is only hardening suspicions that Bush secretly intends a military strike. And from the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the British run into a firestorm in Basra. From the Associated Press on May 6th, a British military helicopter apparently was hit by a missile and crashed into the southern port of Basra, triggering a confrontation in which jubilant Iraqis pelted British troops with stones, hurled firebombs, and shouted slogans in support of a radical Shiite cleric. Iraqi police said 4 British crew members died in the crash. 4 Iraqi adults and a child were reported killed during the ensuing melee when Shiite gunmen exchanged fire with British soldiers who hurried to the scene. About 30 civilians were injured. This was reminiscent of other outbursts of Iraqis cheering the deaths of foreigners, and the chaotic scene was widely shown on Iraqi state television and on the Al Jazeera satellite station. The violence underscored that discontent over the presence of foreign soldiers has been growing among Iraq's majority Shiites, even though they have generally steered clear of the Sunni-dominated resistance movement. And from editorandpublisher.com, Bush approval rating hits the 20s for the first time. President Bush's job approval rating has fallen to 29%, its lowest mark of his presidency, and down 6% in only 1 month, according to a new Harris poll. And this poll was conducted previous to the recent revelations about NSA phone surveillance. And finally, police clash with anarchists in Athens, from the Associated Press, on May 6th. Some 30,000 people marched in an anti-war and anti-globalization demonstration that also saw anarchist attacks on banks, shops, and police vehicles. Police said groups of hooded anarchists torched at least 4 banks, smashed shop windows, and threw gasoline bombs at police buses outside the capital's police headquarters before running off down side streets. Officers used tear gas to disperse a small group of anarchists near the U.S. Embassy just north of the city center, and in a central square where rioters threw stones and chairs at a McDonald's restaurant. 1 policeman and 2 demonstrators were injured, and 30 suspected rioters were detained, authorities said.
That was Steve Diamond with News You Need to Know.
They're saying Greenpeace is terrorist. If what they say is true, if that's what Greenpeace does, I'm proud to be a terrorist too. Like these.
That was Pierce Woodward with Evildoers from his first album, Leave No Millionaire Behind. This is Amy Antonucci with Making Waves. Today we're speaking with Pierce Woodward and Anna LaGuarda, co-founders of the Band Together Project. Since early January, they have been sending groups into New York City subways every weekend to play music and talk to people about illegal detention and abuse of prisoners in the war on terror. They use their concerts to distribute information and collect signatures on postcards and letters to New York legislators that express opposition to the current U.S. policy toward prisoners in the war on terror. Welcome, Pierce and Anna.
Thanks a lot. It's nice to be here.
Thank you.
Let's begin by hearing more about Band Together, what it is and what you're doing with it.
The idea behind Band Together is exploring ways to use music to basically inspire people to take action on behalf of important human rights causes. Basically, we believe that music can have that effect on people. It can really put them in touch with their best human instincts. And it also has a way of sort of gathering people together. When you hear music and you see people playing music in a public place, a lot of times you go over and watch for a little while, and it sets a really nice tone, creates a nice atmosphere or environment. And we basically try to capture that moment and be prepared to then raise these questions, these human rights questions, to people who are listening to the music. And we find that it works really, really well to talk to people about a human rights issue when they're standing there listening to music. So that's the concept. The way that it works in New York is we've been doing it in the subways. That's a place where you get an amazing just cross-section of humanity in the New York City subways. It's really easy, rain or shine, for musicians to go down there. And usually we don't get harassed. We can just set up just about anywhere and start playing. People gather. They're standing there waiting for the train. They have nothing else to do. So in addition to the musicians, we always have one or two people down there with materials and clipboards and things for people to sign, basically actions for people to actually take once they've been kind of sensitized to the issue. And as you said in the intro there, the issue that we're focusing on right now is the way prisoners are being treated in the war on terror. Not that there aren't plenty of other issues to talk to people about, but that seems like, to me, one of the most atrocious things that's going on in our names right now.
How did this project start?
I've been experimenting with combining music with politics for the past 4 or 5 years and trying to write political songs with actual political lyrics, you know, stories and topical songs. And also I've played around with the idea of combining music as sort of the background with, you know, sound bites, just sort of as a way of juxtaposing kind of upbeat sounding music with somewhat more serious subject matter. And I found that old time, like Appalachian fiddle music, which is what I happen to really like to play, is a really cool backdrop for these kinds of conversations, because the music is so happy sounding. It's dance music, essentially square dance music. It's just sort of, rather than just having a human rights issue be against the blank silent backdrop where it can come off as sounding melodramatic, or people feel bad about it or end up feeling guilty that they're not doing something about it and just having this sort of bad feeling, by juxtaposing it with this really upbeat music, it can create this more hopeful setting for those conversations. So that's what I set out to do. Out of playing this music myself, I have an enormous network of friends all around the country, and I had about 20 or 25 of them right in New York City where I live. So I just started calling up my friends, basically, and going out to the sessions. There are at least 3 different weekly music sessions in Irish pubs, generally. They go from about 9 o'clock at night till 2 in the morning. And if you want to connect with that community, it's really easy. You just show up at the sessions, and in between tunes, you mention the idea. And it was really easy to get people out and excited about it. And so we started up in first weekend of January, and we've been going every Sunday since then.
How did you get involved, Anna?
When I've gone out, it's been more as one of the talkers. And for me, it's been a really great way to feel like I can do something politically important and speak to other people and connect with other people about an issue that's meaningful to me. But as Pierce was saying, to do it in not a negative way and not a sort of annoying, "Do you have a minute for prisoners in Guantanamo?" Mm-hmm. sort of way, which always sort of annoys me when I'm approached in that way on the subway or whatever. So I went out, I think in mid-January, with the group and became really inspired by that experience, by the conversations that I had with random strangers, and really feeling like, wow, more people care about this than we know about, and more people want to be doing something about it than we know about. So just going out really inspired me to up my involvement in the project and try to expand it into Boston, which is where we are right now. It's a little bit harder in Boston because you have to have permits for playing in the subways, so we're probably going to be playing outside for now, for as long as we can.
I'd like to hear more about the reactions you have been receiving from people.
I've definitely been very impressed and inspired, for the most part, with people's reactions. As we've been going along, we've been trying to figure out the best way to approach people, because there are clearly different ways that you can bring it up. At first, it can be a little awkward because people are just standing there sort of jamming to the music, and you don't want to go over and be like, "Do you know what your country's doing?" and scare them. But you also have a limited amount of time, so you really have to make sure to approach them in a fast and to the point way that's also in line with what we're trying to do, is have music as a way to connect and really feel bonded with strangers. It's definitely been a work in progress in terms of figuring out the best way to approach people. It's sort of akin to approaching random people at a party, I've found, and I just go into that mode and be sociable and fun when I approach them and steer the conversation towards where I want it to go. It's been pretty successful. I've gotten about 80% of the people who I've talked to on the subways to eventually sign the petition or take some literature or ask about coming back to one of our informational parties or something like that. I think what's been really great about this project so far is realizing how many people want to be doing something and want to be politically involved but don't know how and don't really want to be going to a rally and standing there and holding a sign. And it's been really great just within my friends to see people latch onto this project as a way to feel like they're doing something and be doing it in a different way and in a very mindful, planned way. That's been really great for me, and I know that's been great for other people who have been starting to get involved in this project. And I think that's what's exciting a lot of times to the people that we talk to on the subways, is they feel like, oh yeah, it stinks, but what can we do about it? And we say, well, here are some things you can do. You can sign this petition, you can read this book, you can talk to other people about it, and we have a couple different things that we can give people to do. So I think that's been something really exciting for me and the people that I've talked to.
I've been out on most of these expeditions, and I have approached people ranging from a Navy guy, maybe 19 years old, who had just gotten back from Guantanamo and was in my face, nearly physically assaulting me, telling me I didn't know what I was talking about and this was the most unpatriotic thing he'd ever seen, to I think the development director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is the legal center that is organizing all the representation for the Guantanamo detainees. A guy from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, one of my favorite organizations in the world, showed up and signed our petition and gave his email address. So part of that is a product of being in New York City, but also you just never know who is going to be walking by, and you're going to get the whole range. And that's a little bit daunting at first for the people who have volunteered to go out and talk to people. I've warned them, or not warned them, but explained, you never know what the reaction is going to be. I would put the favorable reactions around 80% too, just like what Anna said, overwhelmingly supportive in New York. But as far as what people already know about the issue, there's the whole range as well. People who have never heard of what we're talking about, to people who are very savvy and follow it very closely and are excited to at least lend their signature and an email address and take some literature with them and study up a little bit more. So we've been lucky. We've gotten a lot of materials from the Center for Constitutional Rights, including these books that they've been giving us for free to give out, called Guantanamo, What the World Should Know, and it's basically a maybe 200-page interview with Michael Ratner, who's one of the lead attorneys in this case for the Center for Constitutional Rights. So that's a really great thing to be able to hand someone when they really show interest and they've been following it in the New York Times or whatever, but to be able to say, here, go a little deeper.
So a real combination of basic education and giving people tools to do more.
Yeah, I mean, basically what we're giving them right now is an opportunity to sign a letter to New York senators, get on our email list, and take some literature with them. And a lot of people are fairly cynical about whether faxing a petition to Hillary Clinton is really going to have any effect, but basically, with this issue, the executive branch is sort of hopeless, and they've basically taken a lot of the power away from the judicial branch, and all that's really left in our government is the legislators, who are at all accountable to us and have any ability to respond to what average citizens think and feel. So basically we're saying, if you don't sign this, if you don't express anything to Hillary, then she's going to assume that you're okay with how she voted on this most recently, and so you've got to at least let her know that you disagree. Then we can try to build the movement from there. You know, obviously it's not going to probably change anything anytime soon to just be faxing these people once or twice a month with some signatures, but it's a starting point. It's sort of the bare minimum. So we're definitely actively trying to think of what else we can offer people in terms of ways to get involved with this. And we're not the only ones working on this issue. I mean, there's tons of organizations that are really thinking up lots of creative things to do to try to build a movement to close Guantanamo first, because it's so symbolic of the whole problem, but then to expand that into a better policy towards prisoners in general.
Well, it really sounds like, along with the focus on this particular issue, what you're trying to do is get people to step up and become citizens again, which a lot of people seem to have really fallen away from and don't know how to do anymore. You're listening to Making Waves. We're speaking today with Pierce Woodward and Anna LaGuarda about their project Band Together. Band Together combines music and politics in an effort to reach people on human rights issues. I'm really interested in the percentage that you spoke of, that 80% of people seem really with you, whether they need explanations first or not, because doing the weekly vigil in Portsmouth Market Square and sometimes in Dover, we're seeing a similar split. Certainly, the people who respond, probably more like 90 at this point, are really favorable. And I know for us, having been vigiling for many years, we see it as a huge shift that we remember when it was really more the other way around, 80% negative and 20% positive. So I think that's an interesting statement on the mood of the country. So it's actually a really good time and a really teachable moment, as they say, a time when people are interested and not already hostile. A good time to be out there.
And we're hoping that even more so when they're listening to happy music and out standing in a subway station where they'd have to be anyway.
Yeah, and what we're trying to do is capture that goodwill and take it from just like a smile or a nod or a dollar and trying to actually figure out how to put these people into the movement itself as opposed to sort of supportive bystanders, you know.
As far as the focus that you are taking, what sort of points do you bring up when you approach someone?
Well, you know, it really depends on each person. Of course, some people are just like, yeah, give me the pen. And some people are like, why should I care about this at all? And some people, frankly, say, well, you know, they bombed us a couple years ago, and I don't want that to happen again. So if a few innocent people have to be kept in prison for a few years in order to make absolutely sure that that never happens here again, I guess that's okay with me. What we bring up with those people is that somewhere around 90% of the people down there are thought to be or known to be completely innocent. And the military people down there admit that. So the question we raise is, you know, how does it benefit you to hold innocent people in prison indefinitely? If they're known to be innocent, okay? Someone might be an actual, quote, terrorist. We don't really try to argue that point, because the really most egregious part of this seems to me that there are people down there innocent. They haven't even had trials, but it's just known that through the intelligence gathering that has been done, they're known to be just regular goat farmers or taxi drivers, had the wrong name, in the wrong place. Somebody turned them in order to get their hands on the bounty that the United States was offering at the time. And so it's just the wrong people. And so we'd ask, what's the point of holding those guys? Then there's also the idea of what kind of example are we setting as Americans for when our guys are caught and captured. That's another important one. You know, if we're doing this to our supposed enemies, then we won't be able to claim the moral high ground when the tables are turned. So that's another way we argue. But fundamentally, what resonates most with me is this idea of due process. And when you arrest someone and imprison them, you need to charge them with some sort of crime and give them a fair trial, no matter who that person is or where you found them and what you think they may or may not be connected to. That kind of legal policy has been in place since the Middle Ages, dates back to Magna Carta, England, where you just can't lock people up indefinitely without telling them what they're locked up for and giving them a trial. And that's exactly what we're doing to these guys in these prison camps.
Today on Making Waves, we're speaking with Pierce Woodward and Anna LaGuarda about their project called Band Together, in which musicians in the New York City subways, and soon in Boston as well, play music and engage in conversations with passersby about issues around Guantanamo and treatment of prisoners in the U.S. War on Terror. Do you have any particular interesting stories of people that you've met or talked to that you could share with us?
I already told you about the military guy. That was probably the most intense thing that's happened, was having this guy in my face poking me in the chest with two fingers. I've approached homeless people who say, I don't have an address, but can I sign your petition anyway? I've approached illegal immigrants who said, sorry, I mean, I love what you're doing, but I can't sign because I'm illegal. Musicians who get excited and hand me CDs. I usually go home with one or two CDs of people who want to figure out a way to get involved. So it's awesome being in New York, where there's so many different types of people, and getting to just see the sort of common humanity that everybody basically shares when you approach them about such an obvious abuse of humanity. So
the most interesting people that I've talked to are the ones who really want to engage in dialogue and are not necessarily from the start, oh yeah, let me sign, of course, but who take a little bit more convincing, or who say, is this really going to help anyway? Because I think it's important for us as the people running the project to constantly be questioning the usefulness of what we're doing and our approach. And so it's really great when I find somebody on the subway who makes me think of that and helps me to work through that right there and then with them and say, well, this is why we think it's useful. What Pierce was talking about, this being our last place in the government to target. And I always say, well, we've spoken with some lawyers who are representing detainees, and they say that this is useful too. So, and just try to give support to what we're doing, but also with the, yeah, you know, we don't know, but it's our duty and it's what we believe in. So will you join us? And it's been really great to have those conversations with people and figure things out with them and watch them figure things out too and realize that they don't have to feel so shut down, because I think that that is a really big problem right now for a lot of people who do care. And I see this project as a real way to involve people, as you were saying earlier, who might not feel like they can be involved, even though they care and want to be.
That just reminds me of conversations I've had with friends who I've invited to participate and have questioned whether it would be a useful way to spend their Sunday afternoon. And it is tough to try to convince someone that it's important to take this stand when, yes, by the time we're done this afternoon, the policy won't have changed, and it probably isn't going to change even in the next year or 2 years, or it might take 10 years, I don't know, maybe 100. But there is a story that I came across recently in Pete Seeger's autobiography, one of my heroes, of course, Pete Seeger, and he tells a story of a demonstration in Union Square in New York City, an anti-war event, I think around the Vietnam War era, and it was in the middle of the night, and there was this guy standing there, basically one of a small handful of people holding a sign. And Pete heard a passerby ask this guy, do you really think you're going to change the world by standing there and holding that sign? And the guy's response was, no, but I'm going to make sure the world doesn't change me. So that's part of it too. For us personally, who are we if we don't speak out about these kinds of issues?
Noam Chomsky is always saying, It's about looking in the mirror and deciding what are you going to do so you can live with yourself and look in the mirror every day. So tell me your plans. What are the plans for the project?
We're trying to up what's going on with Band Together in Boston. So right now we are gathering musicians and people, as Pierce called them, to go out and try to make it more of a regular thing in Boston. We've been hosting informational parties in Boston and New York where we invite everybody we possibly can think of, both from our email lists and from our personal friend lists. We've had different speakers come to these events, like lawyers or people from the Catholic Workers, who are another group who's involved in this, and just to give people information and also create a space for dialogue and for learning from each other and brainstorming ideas and strategies and getting people excited. So probably there will be more of those as we expand and hopefully go to new cities. And we want to do some sort of large event this summer in New York, which is in the works right now.
Yeah, and basically continuing to explore ways that you can merge music and activism. It doesn't have to be in a subway. A lot of places in this country don't have subways, or it might even not make sense to play outdoors. I'm thinking of strip mall type of towns and suburbs where you'd get kicked off of the sidewalk for holding a fiddle or whatever. So, and it doesn't need to be limited to string band music either. That's just where we're starting. Like I said, that's who I happen to know the most of. So we've been playing around with ideas of having these materials out on tour with different bands who are supportive as part of their merch table, you know, next to the CDs. Also have some literature and playing outdoors, like what we're going to be doing in Boston. We're having a benefit concert in Brooklyn on June 8th. I think we'll also try to invite an expert, too, who can kind of field questions in the midst of a live concert, because I don't like to be up on stage and just say, there are some pamphlets in the back if you're interested. You know, it's like I want to take the whole issue and put it front and center as part of the performance, because that's the whole concept of the project.
Here in New Hampshire, we don't have subways, but we do, in many towns, have town squares, for instance, in Portsmouth and Dover. And we're coming into the good weather season for being outside and doing this. If people around here are interested, can they contact you, for instance, to get some information and some ideas about how to proceed?
We have an email address, bandtogether.us@gmail.com. And if anybody emails, we're very good about replying, and we can send copies of the petition that we've been using in New York and Boston for people to bring along with them. And we could even send them other materials that we have if they give us a mailing address. And, you know, links to articles. We have a lot of information that we can send to people, and any support that they would want in terms of ideas of how we've been doing it, or somebody to talk to brainstorm how they can do it.
For the non-email folks, how might they contact you?
We have a Band Together hotline, and that number is 603, New Hampshire number, 303-6029.
Pierce and Anna, it was great to have you here. I wonder what closing thoughts you might have for our listeners.
Well, my closing thoughts are that this project has been a lot of fun for me, and I've seen those around me have a lot of fun with it too. So I encourage everybody to get involved with us however they want to.
My closing thought would be, we've been doing this as string bands because that's, like I said, that's sort of what I know, but there's no reason why someone who tap dances or does magic tricks or sings opera or anything that basically draws some attention, puts a smile on people's face, will do the trick. It doesn't even need to be music. There's a lot of people in New York also trying to figure out some sort of street theater ideas to use here too. So as long as it's not super depressing. The key thing seems to be to create a really happy, upbeat, uplifting vibe.
Right. That's the main point, that it doesn't have to be boring and sad to be politically active.
Thanks so much for coming in. It was great to have you.
Thanks a lot for having us, Amy.
Thanks, it's been great.
And now for a song by Pierce Woodward called Diplomat Voice.
There were birds falling from the sky, fishes drowning in the mud, people between appointments filled.
farmers had to eat their seeds, making bread from salt and dirt. People who worshipped God while wearing a sweatshop shirt. I hear my diplomat voice debating. Storms tearing through the southern seas, children drowning in the road. People with air conditioning said, what warming of the globe? There were lawyers laying out the terms of love, homophobes who craned their necks. People resisting war by having kinky sex. Diplomat voice calling up the AM show with a belligerent host who claims to be a normal Joe. He asked if I was married, he asked if I was gay. I said I'm gay every day. A bang followed by a burning smell. The dollar landed with a thud. People we knew the next one was fire instead of flood. There was a circular rally with no PA. When it was my turn, I said, people, it's not about uniting blue and hear my diplomat voice debating a Republican in the seat next to me on the protest bus to Washington. I asked if he felt guilty. He said he felt betrayed. He asked if I felt innocent. I said guilty.
Was Diplomat Voice by Pierce Woodward.
Thanks, Amy. And Damon Thomas here. With me today for this segment of Making Waves is a very special guest. Joining us live here in the WSCA studio is Carol Shea Porter of Rochester. Carol is one of four Democrats who will compete in the primary on September 12th for the right to challenge two-term U.S. Representative Jeb Bradley, a Wolfboro Republican, in the November 7 election. I invite our listeners to stay tuned to what will surely be an informative and engaging discussion on a range of issues that are vitally important to persons throughout not only the Seacoast, but also the entire state, region, and nation. Carol, first of all, thank you for taking the time to be with us today on Portsmouth Community Radio, and welcome to Making Waves.
Thank you for having me on the show. I apologize in advance for the hoarseness.
Okay, that's fine. Live radio at its best. Let me begin with a brief bit of background. You are running for a seat in the United States House of Representatives, a position currently occupied by Jeb Bradley, representing New Hampshire's 1st Congressional District, which encompasses Manchester, the Mount Washington Valley, the Lakes Region, and the Seacoast. Why are you running for Congress?
I'm running for Congress because I have two children, and I want my children to have the same future and the same opportunity that I was given by this great country. I would like to go down to Washington and be part of the group that cleans up the corruption in Washington and that restores a moral budget for our country and restores our standing in the world.
Now, what do you believe qualifies you to run for Congress?
I think my education and my life experience would serve this state well. I have an undergraduate degree in social services from the University of New Hampshire, and I have a master's degree in public administration. And I have worked all of my life to serve other people. I have experience setting up agencies, social service agencies. I've worked with different age groups. I know what they need. I also taught current issues for many years, and I do know what happens when certain policies are passed in Washington, the impact that it will have in the communities across the country. And I'd like to be part of that so that we can make life better inside of our communities.
How do your qualifications, as opposed to your stance on the issues, compare with or match up with those of the other Democratic candidates? Or how do they differ from those of the other Democratic candidates?
First of all, I know Jeb Bradley better than anybody else does. For more than 2 years, I've been challenging him to speak up for the people of New Hampshire, not to stand there as a follower, silent in all these issues that are so critical. So I know how he thinks, and I know what his voting record is, and I believe I can challenge him the most. I also have the experience of paying attention to federal issues for more than 20 years and teaching them. So I do understand all of the federal issues, what's come before, and how the situation now is impacting. I understand this Bush administration, and I know what Jeb Bradley has done for the Bush administration and against the people in New Hampshire. So I think I'm very well qualified to go speak up for the rest of us.
Let's touch on some of those issues, if we might. Taking maybe just one or two off the top of your head, as far as what the congressman has or hasn't accomplished on behalf of the regular workaday, middle-class, working-class citizens of New Hampshire. How has Jeb Bradley been part of a program or an onslaught against some of the things that we most hold dear as Americans?
Well, there are many issues. First of all, the Iraq War. I think he's probably the last person in New Hampshire who believes the war is going well. And I think he's withheld information from us about that war. For example, almost getting shot down on the way out and then being able to write articles across the state newspapers about how great the morale was. He's also failed us by just making it possible for the Bush administration to do what they've done to the rest of us. He has voted for the tax cuts for the top 1%. He's created 48% of the deficit, which is a huge problem. 48% of that deficit was created by those tax cuts for the top 1%. So I think he's been fiscally irresponsible. I think he has gone along with the Tom DeLay kind of thought in Washington. And if he didn't approve of it, he certainly never said anything. So he either held his nose and pretended he couldn't smell what was happening in the room, or he just ignored it. So I think he's responsible for much of what has happened because he enabled George Bush, Tom DeLay, and the rest of them to do what they've done to all of us.
You know, many of the listeners to this show are part of a progressive constituency that is absolutely shocked and angry and disgusted by what they perceive as an appalling lack of vision, maybe even of courage and initiative on the part of the established leadership of the Democratic Party, the so-called opposition party. The argument goes something like this. The Republican majority in Congress, aided and abetted by the Bush administration, has over the last 5+ years absolutely wreaked havoc on working-class families, average citizens, and the weakest among us. And the situation has created a tremendous opportunity for Democrats to step in and speak out on behalf of and otherwise defend the interests of the vast majority of Americans against the Republican onslaught. The Democrats, particularly the leadership typified by maybe senators such as Hillary Clinton or Joseph Lieberman, they failed to seize this opportunity and instead have actually caved into this Republican onslaught and have failed to articulate a unified, sustained opposition. How does your candidacy address these concerns of this progressive constituency?
Well, first of all, I am a Democrat, and I'm proud to be a Democrat. When you look back at all the good social programs that have served this country so well, they've come from the Democratic Party. So I have my feet firmly planted inside the party. However, I do think that we need to speak independently, and we have to put aside party labels sometimes and show some profiles and courage. And I think that what's happened now is that because of the pressure from the Republican Party and the pressure from the media, many Democrats have been maybe quieter than they should have been, but I intend to speak up and speak out. So I think independence is crucial for any candidate who wants to go to Washington now.
For our listeners, I will say that you're listening to Making Waves on Portsmouth Community Radio. My guest is Carol Shea Porter, one of four Democratic candidates vying for a seat in Congress representing the New Hampshire's 1st Congressional District. Carol, on your website, which is www.carolforcongress.com, you identify six categories where you set forth your positions, and these six categories are civil liberties, the economy, education, environment and energy, healthcare, and national security. Because we only have limited time, I would like to direct our listeners to go to your website to read about your positions in detail. But not everyone has a computer, and since this is a radio show, I invite you to give our listeners a brief statement summarizing your stand on each of these categories. Maybe we can begin with civil liberties and the economy, for starters.
Okay. Civil liberties are eroding in this country, and it's a result of the Bush administration and those in Congress who have not spoken up against their actions. I believe that the government should stay out of anything that is not a threat to national security, and that includes a large range of issues. And I'm frightened by the Bush administration and the go-along Congress who have allowed them to intrude. They're doing electronic surveillance. They're snooping in places they don't belong. And it's not even effective. I read today that actually, when you look at all the billions of phone calls that they've monitored, if they had found anybody, they probably would have been trumpeting that by now. And that it probably distracts a lot of the National Security Agency workers who have to filter through billions of phone calls, literally trying to find a needle in a haystack. So I'm against all of that unless they can prove that there's some risk to us and they have a search warrant or some kind of legal authority to do that.
Which has always been the constitutional standard in any event.
That's right. This is not a radical point of view unless you take a look at the Bill of Rights as radical. This Bill of Rights is the envy of the world. Why we would be so willing to trash it, or at least not to insist that the government enforce our rights, is frightening.
The economy, your position there.
The economy, I'm so concerned about this deficit. I believe in fiscal conservatism. I think they go together very well with being a progressive. And that 48% of that deficit, as I indicated, is a result of the tax cuts. Another 37% is a result of what we've been spending in Iraq and on other defense issues. We must get a handle on this because we are borrowing money from the Chinese to finance all this. So if you want to talk about a national security issue, what if the Chinese, a communist country, I might point out, decides not to buy our bonds anymore and not to finance this? So the Republicans have really become the big spenders. And in order to get a handle on this economy, we have to restore those tax cuts for the rich. And when I talk about that top 1%, I'm talking about individuals who earn more than $400,000, couples who earn more than $800,000. It's patriotic to pay your fair share of taxes, and I'm calling on them to do that. And when I get to Washington, I will vote to restore those funds because we must have them in the Treasury in order to get our economy in place and be able to pay our debts.
The subject of education. Surely public education has taken a severe hit over the last decade or so, particularly in the last 5 or 6 years. Your comments and thoughts on that?
I think we need to scrap the No Child Left Behind Act. I don't think it ever did what they said it was going to do, and I don't believe they actually thought it would do that. It's unfair to the children, it's unfair to the teachers, and it's unfair to the administration. And it denies the fact that there's immigrant children and other children who come into communities who need to be served, who need to get the same education. And what they're doing is they're testing them instead of working with them and for them. So I think that we do need to put assets into education, but we have to scrap that. By the way, that was not funded properly either. So if they had really intended for it to serve the people as they claimed, they would have funded it.
Environment and energy, two absolutely critical areas. They always have been, but it seems that those environmental and energy issues have certainly come to the fore of late. Your thoughts?
The environment is not something that would be nice to get around to if we can afford it. The environment is critical for our well-being, for our health, and for our ability to live on this planet. So I think we need to start taking this very seriously. And when you look at the Bush administration, once again, and Jeb Bradley, in the rest of the Republican Congress, you can see that the emphasis is not really on the environment. Showing up to pick up an award because you save one little particular piece of land does not make you an environmentalist. The only way you can really claim to be an environmentalist is if you put forward a program that actually prevents this kind of pollution, and that you treat it and you punish the corporate violators, which they do not do, and you actually set about teaching conservation. I think that conservation should be taught in the school from the very beginning, and we should reward conservation by all kinds of tax advantages. And people should be able to walk down the aisles of Walmart and every other business and pick up items that will help us to achieve our goals.
Healthcare is in a deplorable state of affairs in this nation. Your comments, and what initiatives might you introduce to counter the trend towards less health care for more people?
46 million people do not have health insurance. Millions more people are underinsured or pseudo-insured. They can't afford to go to the doctor. It's time for a change, and it's time to really address this issue. I am calling for single payer. I'd like to see medical care for everybody, and I'd like to see it through Medicare. And the reason for that is because Medicare is already in existence, and people are familiar with it. Businesses are familiar with it. Physicians and hospitals are. I'd like to see everybody enrolled in it. Look, it's to our benefit to be healthy and productive citizens. Children deserve to have good health care, and senior citizens certainly do also. But what about the rest of us? I don't think that people who are working and who are trying very hard to produce for this country should be penalized and charged the way they have been charged for health insurance. I think it's a burden to small business that can no longer afford to carry this, and actually it's a burden on big business as well. The time is ripe. It just calls for some political courage to say, let's have Medicare for everybody, because in the end it will save us money. And Medicare has about a 2% administrative rate. Insurance companies, who work so hard to keep from paying you what you're due, have 14-17%, maybe even up to 37% administrative costs. It's not a very efficient way to deliver health care. We are the only country in the Western democracies that does not provide this, and we are not the healthiest country. We pay up to 2.5 times more than other countries pay for health care, and yet we do not get what we pay for because we do not have the record of being the healthiest country. So let's put Medicare in for all. We can do this. We have to do it. No more bake sales for a kidney. I think it's an embarrassment in the richest country in the world.
On the subject of national security, I recall a headline in yesterday's newspaper reciting the fact that the House of Representatives just approved a $513 billion military spending package. Quite apart from the issues of the war, which we'll get to in a moment, and wartime spending, which that spending has been separate from the actual military budget for the most part, address these issues of national security. How can you calm people's fears? We're living in a climate of fear where fear has been whipped up, you know, sometimes for political purposes. Address the issue of national security, if you would, as you did on your website, and share with your listeners your concerns over these issues.
Okay. On 9/11, I was on the Beltway in Washington, D.C. Never a good place to be, but it was a terrible place to be that day. My husband was in a federal building. My daughter was in Annapolis, the capital of Maryland, which they locked down. And my son was home alone at age 12 watching people jump from buildings. Was I afraid? Of course I was afraid. But fear cannot be a full-time job forever. And the Bush administration has capitalized on this to make excuses for enormous, absolutely enormous gifts to defense corporations who work hand-in-hand with the government. So I can't say that budget is a moral budget, because it's not. And I think we have to look at it and figure out what actually is for national defense and what's not. I do believe in a strong national defense, but I think if you want to keep us safe, you first need to make sure we do the simple things, such as protecting our borders. Instead of trying to spy on Americans, we probably should be inspecting the cargo that's loaded into the belly of an airplane, or inspect the cargoes that come from ships into our ports. That would be security. But to spy on my neighbor's phone calls and to spy on who my neighbor's writing to is not going to make me any safer. And I think we know that.
On the issue of the war itself, the war in Iraq, possibly followed by an engagement with Iran in some case, in some way, This war has sapped the country of hundreds of billions of dollars. It's taken the lives of tens of thousands of soldiers and Iraqi citizens. It wages on without any apparent end. This has to be a centerpiece, many people would suggest, of anyone's campaign. How do we deal with this? Your thoughts on the war situation, why we're there, why we continue to be there, and what you would propose as far as a solution to this really an overarching crisis.
I can't tell you why we're there because I don't know why we're there. I am the only candidate who's calling for a withdrawal, setting a date and withdrawing. Look, we went in there for so-called weapons of mass destruction. They weren't there. Then we said we were building a democracy. Now, they just had an election in Iraq. This is a great time to leave. We'll be able to say that we put some kind of democratic system into place there, and it's time to go. And then we need to stick to it. It's pretty arrogant to assume that we have the answer for an area that's been battling for hundreds and thousands of years. And the reality of all this is the only reason there was peace before we got there was because they had a dictatorship. And that's not what we want to be enforcing either. So it's time to just go, say that we, you know, gave them some kind of a government, and exit now.
Would you work to take action in Congress to bring the troops home now?
Yes, I would.
Let me ask one other question. Actually, well, put it this way. Deborah Vanderbeek, who is Congressman Bradley's chief of staff, was quoted in this past Sunday's Boston Globe as saying that Bradley plans to campaign on his work for the district. And I quote her, "We look forward to a vigorous debate on the issues," she said, and continuing to quote her, "and we will continue to do the job we are doing in Congress now." Your response?
That's why I'm running. Because the job that he's doing on us in Congress right now is a miserable, miserable record. So I think we can do a lot better than that. And I'm running because I plan to go to Washington and actually serve the people of New Hampshire and to speak up for the rest of us.
Do you have any concluding thoughts or remarks that you would like to share with our listeners in the last remaining minute and a half that we have here?
Yeah, I would like to tell everybody that I am humbly asking for your vote. I do know what your issues are. I share those issues. I've lived a life of service to other people, as have most of you. And we know what our fellow citizens need and what our issues are. And I promise to stay engaged and to listen and to carry your concerns to Washington.
Carol, I wanted to thank you very much for appearing here on Making Waves. My guest today has been Carol Shea Porter, one of four Democratic candidates, again, vying for a seat in Congress, currently held by Representative Jeb Bradley, representing New Hampshire's 1st Congressional District. Carol, thanks again for appearing on Making Waves on Portsmouth Community Radio.
Thank you for inviting me.
And I'm Damon Thomas, and I'll turn this back to Amy and Joanne. You're listening to 106.1 FM, WSCALP, Portsmouth Community Radio. Making Waves continues.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.